Welcome back, my dears. I hope, however, that time was spent, there was a sense of being able just to drop in, even just a little bit more into your body, into the various moments. So, as I said before, we'll just move right into the arriving sit. And just a note about your camera. I love when your camera's on, and I know for myself when I'm in meditation classes, camera's on, camera's off. So whatever is going to feel better for you, please take care of yourself. And with that said, I invite each of us to bring our body into a posture that allows the body to feel upright and alert. And this doesn't necessarily mean you have to be sitting. Sometimes people ask, like, or they don't feel comfortable lying down, but if that's what your body needs, take care of your body. But it's more the energetics of alertness, of awakeness, of availability to ourselves, to the teachings. So whatever form your body or shape, what your body wants to be sitting in, allowing yourself just to drop in as we take our seats collectively as daughters of the Buddha, sitting in circles, as I believe women have been doing always, and just even allowing yourself, if it's helpful, kind of in your mind's eye to picture our Sangha. I always have us either in an alpine meadow full of wildflowers or at night around a bonfire beneath an awesome Milky Way laden sky. But to see if you can let yourself drop into at least imagining the felt sense of us sitting together in person. Notice if there's any other movements in the body you might like to make that could bring a little bit more ease, or rolling up and back of the shoulders, or just a dropping in the somatic experiencing courses. One of the great instructions they gave us was imagine putting your attention like behind the belly button, between the belly button and the spine. Closer to the spine, so allowing the energy to rest like down and back, because it can kind of help anchor us away from leaning into the screen, which we can so often do, and inviting in the sense of occupying the back body. And for the anchor today, I'm gonna do one of my favorites. As many of you know, this is just one of my primary practices and working with the elements and just sticking with the earth element, which does include all the others. But just to stay as an invitation of just allowing us to, again, to just drop in the enormous benefit of being able to stay connected to our bodies. And I say this knowing for many of us as women, traumas have not made it so comfortable to be in the body. So this invitation is here to take to the degree to which it fits. Yeah. If there's an area in the body that does feel safe to rest in, the hand, the foot, some part that's neutral, then just allow that to be where you rest. So, as always, if it's helpful to call to mind an image of a mountain. For those of in those folks in Marin, that's sort of Mount Tam, Mount Diablo, East Bay, Mount Fuji, sort of iconic mountains that seem to arise from the horizon. It can be a local hillside. It can be the amazing 100-year-old oaks of the southeast, the redwoods along the West Coast, anything that has that quality of solidity and stability. The rocks, Spirit Rock's iconic image of the tree and the rock. Just as a way of letting the mind identify, oh yeah, steadiness, stillness, the stillness of the mountain that's unperturbed by the winds that blow, the steadiness of rocks. Of those massive old trees, if that's helpful, the hillside. So it is externally, in the natural world around us, so it is internally. The stillness, the stability, the strength, the groundedness of rocks, hillsides, mountains, trees. It's in this form as well, if we but let it be known. So the mind is doing what it does, commenting, judging, comparing, planning, perseverating, figuring something out, whatever. Okay. And we want to almost just come underneath those thoughts. Don't even worry about trying to stop them or do anything with them, but allowing the attention to orient towards the relative stillness in the body. Imagine resting in the bones. Bhikkhu Anālayo, I've been told, sits with a skeleton in his meditation room. And I think for him, it's more about impermanence. But I always bring that image up as just a way like, oh yeah, can I just rest in the skeletal form? The skull, the jawbone, the vertebrae, clavicles, shoulder blades, the rib cage, the pelvic bowl, the long arms, the long bones of the arms and legs. And those smaller dexterous bones of the fingers and the feet, can we just rest here in these bones of ours? As the tree rests in its roots and trunks, as the mountain rests in the mountainness of itself. As a rock sits in its relative stillness, knowing it's had a busy life over the ages, yeah, to get where it is. So it's just this momentary stillness, resting in the bones in this moment. We get caught up in a thought, oh, we come back and we rest in the relative stillness of these bones, nowhere else to go, nothing else to do, aligning ourselves with the truth of our elemental earth nature, steady, grounded, relatively still. And the natural world is our ally. Hey, sweetie, look here. As it is externally, so it is within. And please know there's no such thing as a bad sit. Some may feel more comfortable than others. Okay. We just come and we take our seat and we see how it is. And please again, feel my gratitude that we have the opportunity to sit together on this day. Thank you. And I hope, however the sit went, there's this sort of a settling, a quieting, even when sits are hard. Sometimes like, oh, thank God, bell rang. But just that the effort putting in, whenever we do it, and for however long we do it, we are accruing merit, and it's for our own benefit and everybody else around us for sure. Today, I want to talk in part about this book, one of my new favorite books, Awe, by Dasher Keltner. He works at UC Berkeley. He writes a lot with Greater Good, if some of you subscribe to that. And I will say, I've sort of read through it a couple times, and each time it's like, I'm in such a good mood. So there's something about actually spending time reading about awe that does, it certainly has affected my mood, and I think the science would suggest that it does sort of for all of us. And I feel like it just dovetails so beautifully with the Buddhist teachings of paying attention, of being open, being awake, the Brahma Viharas of the heart opening into friendliness, compassion, joy in particular, equanimity, the sort of the open, steady heart that is then available to be awed by the world. Years ago, there was a kind of a funny clip that was making its way around social media, and it was a comedian sort of poking fun at the overuse of awe or awesome, and sort of like people saying, tie your shoes is awesome. And she's like, it's really not, that's not the right word for it. And she was kind of pointing to the overuse of the word and like, let's use it in particular circumstances in which it's more called for, like Yosemite or something. And part of me, I was thinking about it, I'm like, what if, no, what if it really is a day-to-dayness of the ordinary that through our full awareness and quiet mind, it can just be like, oh my God, that's amazing. Carly and I were sharing before the class that each of us had had our time in nature. And sorry, Carly, to borrow from your story, but she saw a collection of swallows, which I looked up, called a flight or a herd. There's another, a kettle, that's it. A kettle of swallows, how they fly and can take a particular shape. And just listening to you, I was like, oh my God, that's so amazing. I went for a walk earlier this week and came across this one of the wild birds here. It has the nest and feeding the babies. Point being, how do we allow ourselves to pay enough attention to be awed by that which is around us? So in this book entitled Awe, the author talks about the eight natural wonders of life that are awe-inspiring, awe-inducing. I think those would be the right word. One is moral beauty, which is other people's courage, kindness, strength, or people who overcome great obstacles. That was the number one, which I thought was interesting. And he's done studies in 26 different countries of studying awe, you know, how are humans moved by into a place of awe, of reverence, of joy, of delight. There's a particular kind of dwelling place in the brain and the nervous system when we are awed by something. And this notion of the our capacity to be awed by the kindness of others, yeah, or the moral courage, the moral fortitude. You know, of course, Nelson Mandela comes to mind among many on the list that could just go on forever. And even just when we notice it out in the world that someone's being kind to another person, again, that key phrase is like being aware to notice. Sometimes we can move so quickly, we just don't see things. We don't see a flower that's just starting to bud. We don't see the kettle of swallows. We don't see someone's generosity to another person. And that by slowing down, as these teachings really slow us and invite us to do, like, well, notice that the mind is all busy, but there are other places that busyness of the mind can be there. And yet the mind can stay quiet. The body can feel quiet. Right, there can still be a receptivity and availability, even though the mind might just be like doing what it does. We're not so engaged with it, such that then we are available to take in that which is so beautiful. When in my first year, I think of sitting, I sat a lot of retreats. And the second or third one I sat was the New Year's retreat, and I remember coming off the retreat. And it had been cold in Northern California it had been icy. And along my car, there was this really gorgeous spider web that had frozen. Still, I mean, I was still there, like, I'm just amazed by it, partly because I had to spend 10 days being very quiet, but just I was so amazed by just this structure. I'd never seen a frozen, sort of icy, snowed upon spider web. It was like, oh my God, this is so amazing. And again, it's all around us if we but allow the mind to slow down enough and we start looking for it, right? So the mind, what the mind ponders upon, so inclines the mind. If we allow ourselves to go out in the world, be like, I'm gonna look to be awed by something. And there's a study in the book. So he writes that from 55 to 75, we just get happier and happier. Good news. At 75, studies show less so, because then we're worried about dying. That this is coming up more quickly. So he did the study with 75 folks that are 75 and older. And the part of this participants that were required to do is to go on an awe walk, I think at least once a week. And the idea of this walking outside on your awe walk was to allow yourself to be awed by something. So you're looking to pay attention. And you tend to go some, you pick a different place every week. Or if it's the same place, you kind of come at it with beginner's mind, as if you had never seen it before. Yeah. And then I won't show up if, on the camera, but there are pictures there of two women sort of before and after, and facial features totally soften. They look younger, so much softer. I was like, wow. Similarly, and I said this on Monday night, but Jack used to talk about the facial that retreats can produce. If you go on a 10-day retreat and you come in real like tight and anxious, and after 10 days, like, generally many of us kind of feel like, oh, kind of some relaxation and some a more youthful, because of the release of the tension, sort of the radiant beauty can come forward. But I thought it was just so striking that it was a 6-week study. Getting back to the wonders, like, so moral beauty, other people's courage, the collective effervescence, like at a concert or sporting events. I was delighted to hear that one of the sporting events they studied were the Pittsburgh Steelers. I'm from Pittsburgh. So people waving their terrible towels and just the exuberance of a tailgate going into a Steelers game. And I'm old enough so that during the Pittsburgh dynasty in the late 70s, I was there. That was the big deal. Sort of the movement in unison that can happen during wave of a sporting event, whether it's basketball or perhaps University of Iowa's women's basketball game had the same impact. But this way in which when we are with others sort of focused around something, there's that effervescence that comes. And it's one of the reasons I love the Olympics or watching sporting events. I have used the word mudita because it feels similar of this, like the beauty and the joy and the awesomeness of these athletes, what they're able to do. But to in the point of the book, it's like that we're with others. So that collective experience of being together, if it's for a team or again for a concert, nature, right? As I was speaking before, our ability to be to have that connection and sense of awe with nature. In the studies, it shows that in America, nature tended to be the number one source of awe. In China, the number one source of awe was the moral beauty. I'm gonna read this is funny. For the US, it was in nature. For US, it was students. So students in Beijing more commonly found awe and moral beauty, inspiring teachers or grandparents, or the virtuous performances of musicians. For the US students, it was nature. And here's a cultural difference that left us shaking our heads. The individual itself was 20 times more likely to be the source of awe in the United States than in China. The US students could not help but feel awe at themselves for getting an A in a tough class, or receiving a fellowship, telling a hilarious joke, or for the true narcissist, posting a new photo on Tinder. That's America for us. For music, you know, with that sense that sometimes, and I thought about doing some montage of beautiful pictures and poems and music, but said I would not go down that route. But the way that music sometimes, whether it's live or we just hear it, it just gets in our soul. Oh, makes me cry to think about it. Some of the pieces that is just so beautiful. And one, like, how can someone play so beautifully? But that impact, and when we're collectively with others with music, it is just this real transcendental experience that we are moved into something larger than ourselves. Visual design, walking around, the artist's sort of beautiful art structure, architecture, Many come to mind, but that way that we can allow ourselves to be moved, to be awed by the visual beauty or visual design. Indy Goldsworthy comes to mind of his beautiful natural nature sculptures. Many other come to mind as well. Spirituality, the transcendental experience, again, of something larger than ourselves. Sometimes on retreat, we can have this experience of like we're just so quiet and steady, and then so porous to the world around us, and then so available to other realms. The primary practice of mind, which I've talked about before with nine bodies, and that movement from the manifest to the emotional body to the etheric and on up into the astral and spiritual body to be able to kind of abide in those consciousness that are up here. It's like, you're up and out, and in this real being able to rest in this sense of, whew, for lack of a better word, sort of universal love, divinity, and that it's available. And the way that we can sort of move through the octaves of the different levels of consciousness, but even just being able to walk out the door and be awed by, that which is beautiful, it's all of a piece. Life and death, the I'll try not to sort of the awesomeness of sort of when a baby's born. It's like, how is this possible? Similarly, under certain circumstances, death can have that same quality when there's a real peaceful death of that transition. And then the final, the eighth wonder of life is the epiphanies, when we suddenly totally understand the essential truths about life that can come in these moments, these insights. Similarly, when we're on retreat, the insights can come. This is an insight practice, right? When we step outside of a mind that's chattering and commenting and judging and planning and rehearsing, when we're not in that headspace, and there's just this stillness, and the heart is open, that's when the insights can come. And they can be very simple, but they can be life-changing. He also talks about wonder. The mental state of openness, questioning, curiosity, and embracing mystery. Those who find more everyday awe show more evidence of wonder, more that they are then op more open to new ideas, to what is unknown, to what language can't describe, to the absurd, to seeking new knowledge. In a state of wonder that awe allows, the thought process is more rigorous and energized. And sort of that notion of sort of being dumbstruck by awe, he's like, N no, the mind is really engaged. There's an alertness, there's an awakeness of, oh my goodness, because I would imagine there's such a congruence in the heart and the mind and the body saying yes and being moved by something that's so beautiful. In moments of awe, we shift from a sense that we are solely in charge of our own fate. And striving against another person, and sort of that it's that individualistic, it's mine, and it's through my efforts alone that I can accomplish X, Y, and Z. But in moments of awe, we shift into a sense that we are part of a community. We are sharing essential qualities and interdependence. He speaks about, I think it's William James's phrasing of gives rise to saintly tendencies that arises in all qualities of these eight wonders of life. That awe inspires sacrifice, as it inspires us to give that most precious resource of ours, time. There's a study that somewhere, like in a stadium or something, they had people like, okay, first everybody just walk around by yourselves and walk quickly with purpose. And sort of all these bodies are kind of walking around. And then the next exercise, okay, we're all going to move together. So in the group, and then they had to do some tasks after they had their walking experiences as a group, and then individually. So that when the, after the individual walkers went, they did a task, and then the individuals as a group then did a task. As you might imagine, those that walked together in unison with collectively, they were so much more collaborative. They were so much more available to working with each other. It had a huge impact on their studies of walking in unison. Those who walked in unison stayed together. They worked harder together on the task and had much more goodwill and collaboration than those who walked individually, which did make me think, I wonder on our walking retreats, what would happen if we just had everyone walk together? What that impact might be of allowing ourselves, that we are somewhat herd animals, to be a part of a herd, to have that sense of collective experience. We are just as likely to find our moral law within awe, who feel more of the wonders of others nearby. I don't think I got that quote right, but I think that what it's pointing to is being able to have the availability to notice when there is moral beauty, when people are walking, standing, moving from a place of integrity. One of the this is the first parami, right? Sila, being in integrity. Then we're again more available, and they do that. These the writings do seem to really track with the paramis and the qualities of the Brahmaviharas. Like when the heart is open, and there's a sense of generosity, integrity, wisdom, wise effort, and so on. That then the impact that it can have both on the brain and the heart and the soul are profound. Okay, I want to read a little bit. Oh, there, in terms of how we defined it, which I had meant to start with, awe is an emotion we experience when we encounter vast mysteries that we don't understand. Because we can find awe anywhere, because doing so doesn't require money or the burning of fossil fuels, some research suggests that just a couple of minutes a day will do to be able to take in the sense of awe and wonder and steadiness. Patience is in here too. So I'm gonna read some poems. This from Rumi, which you've heard from me many times. Today, like every other day, wake up empty and frightened. Don't open the door to the study and begin reading. Take down a musical instrument. Let the beauty we love be what we do. There are 100 ways to kneel and kiss the ground. Right? This invitation, like, stop. We can wake up scared or the heart's beating or in that anxious place. Don't go there. Don't go into that room. You know, take the musical instrument down, put the musical instrument on, go outside in nature, pause, stop. There are 1,000 ways to kneel and touch the ground, to be moved into this place of awe and wakefulness. From Ellen Bass, the thing is, to love life, to love it even when you have no stomach for it, and everything you've held dear crumbles like burnt paper in your hands, and your throat filled with the silt of it. When grief sits with you, it's tropical heat thickening the air, heavy as water, more fit for gills than lungs. When grief weighs you like your own flesh, only more of it, an obesity of grief, you think, how can a body withstand this? Then you hold life like a face between your palms, a plain face, no charming smile, no violet eyes, and you say, yes, I will take you. I will love you again. Right? In the midst of, whether it's an obesity of grief or fear or rage or anger or heartbreak or you name it, we still have the capacity to pause, make a choice. I want to stay here. Where else could I go? And to imagine taking life by his face, that may be just the most ordinary face, like, yes, I will love you again. Grief notwithstanding, rage notwithstanding, anger notwithstanding, the sense of isolation notwithstanding, that is can be a felt experience. And there's this other possibility if we allow it, if we allow ourselves to be moved by that which is beautiful. The peace of wild things. When despair for the world grows in me, and I wake in the night at the least sound in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and I am free. Right? Okay, go outside, rest in the beauty of the natural world, be available to it. The mind is not, he's not chattering on about the concerns about his, the worries about his kids, but allowing ourselves to be enveloped by that which is beautiful. Music, some effervescent community of dance or sporting events, of nature, of art. Yeah, it's like giving ourselves over to be allowing ourselves to be moved. So I want to share another poem, and really, it's because I think it's so beautiful. It just what It's a poem I've shared, but not for a while, and I just really love it, and that's why I'm showing it. It's by Sarah Kay, who I think is just so talented, and it's a poem, Mrs. Ribeiro. I was in northern India at a school run entirely by women volunteers when I heard it for the first time in ages. It was barely audible above the shouting of children, the squeals of laughter bubbling from the schoolyard into the classroom windows. But it was there, the swish of silk saris and the jingle jangle of bangles on thin wrists like wind chimes. This is what learning sounds like, I remember. I remember when I was 5 years old, the principal of my junior school was Mrs. Ribeiro. She was an Indian woman the size of a nightlight and glided like a sailboat through the hallways of our school. Once, when I got close enough to grab a fistful of her draping silk sari, I lifted it to try to see if she had any feet at all. I thought she floated. We begged to be sent to her office, the hanging plants like a jungle above our heads, her quiet laughter. Adults needed appointments, but we did not. And even when she was in a grown-up meeting, all it took was a gentle knock on the door, a peek around the corner, and she was off calling, "Sorry, dear, we'll have to reschedule. I have to see someone else about a very important matter. It's about a gold star. It's about a new diorama. It's about a finished reading book, one level higher than the last time." She visited every classroom, knew every student by name. She spoke to us like we were scholars, artists, scientists, athletes, musicians, and we were. My world was the size of a crayon box, and it took every color to draw her. Once, on a New York City sidewalk, a group of women in brightly colored saris walked by, and someone shouted, "Look, Mom, look at all those principals." My world was the size of a classroom. It was as tall as I could stretch my fingers, calling, "Please let me be the one to read to Mrs. Ribeiro. Let me be the one to show her what I know." Clothes, shirt, pants, socks, shoes, cat, fish, bird. Look at how much I know. She brought us guests and artists and a petting zoo. They set up cages in the parking lot while we were still tucked up in our classrooms, unaware. Rabbits and guinea pigs poked out their noses, but Mrs. Ribeiro came to rest in front of the llama cage. She and the llama considered each other for a long time. She asked if he was tame enough to go outside, to go inside, and the trainers laughed and told her he was plenty tame, but he didn't know how to walk upstairs. So she led him to the elevator. And when the door slid open on the second floor, there stood Mrs. Ribeiro in her bright pink sari with gold bangles and a llama on a leash. She floated from class to class, and we stared and cheered and laughed and shouted, and we tugged at her sari, calling, "Miss, what is that? Where did it come from?" She made us wonder. She made us question. She made us proud of what we had learned. Clothes, shirt, pants, socks, cat, bird, fish. Look at all I've learned. She taught us to share. She taught us to listen when someone else was speaking. And then she let us go. We were dandelion seeds released to the wind, and she asked for no return. We are saplings now with gentle hands. The girl with the messy hairpins and the bright cheek now works at an orphanage in Cameroon. The boy with the color-ordered markers is now a graphic designer in Chicago. The one with the best diorama is now an animal activist in Argentina. And the girl who loved to read aloud is now a poet in India. She let us fly. So I find myself in the front of a classroom. My students tug at my sleeves and say, "Miss, do all poets wear big black boots?" I pray for patience, for wisdom, to find a way to tame all the particular animals of this world, to coax them enough to brave the elevator, to see the door slide open to my students' gaping mouths. All the while they wander, they worry about everything. They worry about what to write. They worry about their grades. They talk over one another until I cannot hear. I tell them, "Listen to one another like you are scholars, artists, scientists, athletes, musicians, like you know you will be the ones to shape this world. Show me how many colors you know how to draw with. Show me how proud you are of what you have learned, and I promise I will do the same." So I'm going to ask you to close your eyes and imagine when you were young that Mrs. Ribeiro was your teacher. who talked to you like you were an artist, a scholar, a musician, who brought llamas to your classroom, who took delight in what you were learning and allowed you to feel a sense of awe. Imagine in your teens, I was someone like Mrs. Ribeiro, who wanted to know what you had learned, whose door was always open for you, who knew you as an artist, a scholar, a musician, a poet. Imagine in your 20s making challenging life decisions. You had the champion of Mrs. Ribeiro in your corner, who stood in awe of who you had become and who you were growing into, who saw you as the poet, the scholar, the artist, the musician. Who saw the fullness of you, who saw the gift and the beauty of your open heart. She held the mirror for you so you could see it in yourself. And in so seeing it for yourself, you could move in the world, open and available to be touched by all that is beautiful, the music, the art, the mountains, the rivers, the trees, the flowers, the kindnesses that you could offer to another, the kindnesses that you would witness. Imagine yourself today. This champion of Mrs. Ribeiro is still behind each of us. Mirroring our own goodness, delight, and wonder, allowing us to move in the world, both taking in that which is awe-inspiring. From the most mundane to the most glorious. It is our birthright to be moved by that which is beautiful. Our bodies are hardwired to notice and to be moved into the reality of our interconnection, our interbeing, our interdependence. That there's a hard wiring to know there's so much more than what our sweet ego wants us to know about the world. Pose the question of what moves you to this place of awe? Is it art? Is it dance? Is it music? Is it being in nature? Is it the moral beauty, the courageous acts of another? Is it being in the presence of life just beginning or life ending? Do some call more to you than others? Is it spirituality where you find the most awe? And asking, well, and in the asking, there's an invitation to, okay, if these are the top three or four areas where it's most easily abundant, this place of awe, the sense of awe, can you build that into your day? for a few moments every day. To orient the mind, not just to the practices that we do week after week towards loving kindness and compassion and joy and equanimity, but awe. What are the circumstances or conditions that allow us to feel into the sense of wonder, of beauty, the mysteries of life? To be inspired to step out of the small sense of ourselves and to realize our connection to each other and the world around us. So I'm going to stop there and thank you so much for your kind attention. And at the end, if you're game, and I'll just name a sort of, maybe we'll leave about 5 minutes or so, because what I'd love to do, and maybe we could do it now, if you're willing to put in the chat things that are awe-inspiring to you. And at the end, I kind of want to read it as if it were a long haiku. So those are my invitations, and just look forward to hearing from you. And thank you again for your attention. And just to share what Mira, I feel like between my Dharma practice and my work with people building community through ecology and connecting with nature and beauty, and the mystery of myself through the trees, that I sort of rest in a place of constant awe and gratitude and amazement, verging on sublime ecstatic bliss half the time about just everything. And just thinking about everything that's led to this moment all the time, causes and conditions, and my ability to appreciate it and all of its wonder blows my mind every time. And the insights have been falling like dominoes lately. Indeed. Maria, thank you for sharing that. And it's such a gift, right? A gift that we can give ourselves to just remember, like, oh, wait, can I allow myself to be moved by or look for something that's beautiful? Okay. If anybody wants to add another a comment about where they find awe, I'll read our song as haiku. That's more than three lines. Okay. Tall trees and tiny birds, the ocean flowers, trees and the moon, being enveloped by the ocean, the consciousness of newborn babies, pregnant women, flowers, cooking, children laughing, dancing with abandon. Technology, us all being connected here from around the world. And my morning thought, my first thought in the morning, welcoming God and my spiritual team to my day is awesome. Then everything from that awareness is amazing. I'm truly amazed that I can live with a silent mind throughout the day, and that's awe-inspiring. Brings awareness and peace. We're experiencing friends recovering from addiction, the sunset in Hawaii, a spontaneous hug from a child. My first experience of awe that I remember was standing on the edge of the Grand Canyon at the age of eight. It took my breath away. Later, two Berkeley moments around food, Thai food, and when I first tasted creme brulee chez Panisse. There, it tastes like this. Music always, especially duets, Yosemite. Dogs, my children sharing their dreams and discovering joy in gardening. Yeah, right. And just checking in how the heart feels as others have, we've shared sort of where we can find awe-inspiring that our availability to be moved. Yeah. One more poem. Will not surprise you that it's from Mary Oliver. It was so good at finding awe in small that everywhere seems. So this is her poem in Blackwater Woods. Look, the trees are turning their own bodies into pillars of light, are giving off the rich fragrance of cinnamon and fulfillment. The long tapers of cattails are bursting and floating away over the blue shoulders of the ponds. And every pond, no matter what its name is nameless now. Every year, everything I have ever learned in my lifetime leads back to this. The fires and the black river of loss, whose other side is salvation, whose meaning none of us will ever know. To live in this world, you must be able to do three things. Love what is mortal, hold it against your bones, knowing your life depends upon it, and when the time comes to let it go, let it go. So, my dears, thank you so much for coming on this Thursday. Please come back next week. Carlita, thank you so much for hosting us so beautifully. and just deep gratitude to you all, and look forward to seeing you next week. Stay safe. Think about all.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.